if this causes a real hardship for you, let me know and we'll figure something out. I have found that in a number of years of teaching, no one ever objects to having something put off. So it just doesn't seem to work that way. And I've got the first homework assignment to give back to you, and I'll give you that at the end of class. Two things I want to say about the homework assignment. One is just a point of clarification. So a lot of you went on to Webb Soil Survey, and you ended up with an area of interest, and you've got, you know, some figure that might look like this, where you've got all these different polygons, and there might be either a number or a, sometimes it's a letter in there. It really depends on the survey, but I just want to make the distinction between what one of these things is and what a soil survey, or what a soil series is, okay? What do we call these things that show up on that map? Polygons. Well, they're polygons, but what?
Pedon?
They're not pedons, no.
Map units.
They are soil map units, okay? And I know at least some of you found soil map units. I'm just going to write an example of one of them on here. Might be something like this. Okay, you might find something like that. What are those two names, Nazaton and Sutler? What do those represent? Yeah, those represent soil series. And I think the key here is that a lot of you are equating a map unit with a soil series, and that is not necessarily the case. There are many map units that may consist primarily of one soil series, but there are a lot of them like this that probably have two and even three soil series in them. They're just arranged in a pattern that they're not able to separate out at the scale that they're doing the mapping. So just recognize these as soil series names, and the whole thing, you know, Nazaton, Sutler, Association, whatever it might be, those are map unit names, okay? Does that make sense? The other thing on the homework too, and it wasn't such a big deal on this first one, or I didn't make a big deal out of it, but you remember on the assignment, I'll quote. Okay, citing sources, almost all of you did that. And you know, this is something in any kind of scientific writing. If you are presenting information that is not your own, you need to write down where it comes from. And sure, I know that you got this stuff off of Webb Soil Survey and official series descriptions, but you still need to write it down and make it clear that you're not presenting this as your own information. And the other thing, I said assignment will be graded on accuracy and professional appearance. Okay, the accuracy, not too big of a deal in this one. Professional appearance, what does that mean to you guys? If something has a good professional appearance, what does that conjure up?
Looks neat.
Okay, it looks neat.
Pretty.
Yeah, whether you realize it or not, and you can argue the merits all you want, but people in the professional world are going to judge your work to a large degree on how it looks. You could have some of the best work in the world, but if you've got a bunch of misspelled words and it's real sloppy looking, people aren't going to take it seriously. And like I said, you can argue the merits of that all you want, but that's really the way it is. And I guess what I'd like for you to do on these assignments is treat it like you are creating a document for either a boss at work. You know, your boss says, I want you to give me some soil series, soil profile descriptions from the study area. You know, so treat it as something you'd be doing on the job, or even a client hires you to give you a real short report on the soils that are present in an area. And think about, okay, is this something that you would want to give to somebody and sign your name to it? And, you know, it's a good habit to get into it. It really is. And I guess the other side of that coin is you can have some real crap, but if it looks nice, people tend to believe it. And that's not a good thing, but I would definitely shoot for quality of work and making it look good. Because that's the best combo. Okay, let's see. Just to get you up to date with where we are or where we aren't, let me show you the schedule here real quickly. If you look at this recently, today is the 27th, and right up here at the top, and we're a little bit off because last Thursday we kind of got onto these soil forming processes, and we really didn't get done because I wasn't able to project them up here. So I want to finish that up, and then we're going to talk about climate as a soil forming factor, and hopefully I can get through that this morning, and then maybe this afternoon what I'll do is cover the organisms, and we'll still be a little bit behind, but it should get us a little bit closer. Okay, so if you remember the other day, we were talking about these things, the generalized processes, and let me back up one. And I don't know if I showed you this diagram, but this is out of the textbook. And what it does is it shows soils as an open system. So it's subject to all these fluxes, inputs of material, losses of material, vertically, laterally, most any way you can imagine, energy inputs, and so on. And so this kind of brings up the idea of soils as a biogeochemical reactor out on the landscape. And we said that what's going on here, we can really put into one of four general categories: additions, losses, transformations, and either translocations or transfers, whatever you want to call it. And we went through a bunch of these, and I'll just show you the picture that goes with it. But we talked about melanization, which is simply the darkening through the addition of organic matter. And you can see a couple of examples here. Normally, we think about the horizon created through melanization as being an A horizon. Cumulization were mineral additions to the soil surface. Best example around here would be some of the volcanic ash that we've received. Our soils around here have from the Cascade eruptions. And this is one of our local soils here. And you can see the upper 40, 50 centimeters of this is just the volcanic ash from the eruption of Mount Mazama. So a pretty significant addition of mineral material to the soil surface. Littering, this is what we think about primarily is the surface accumulation of organic litter and humus like you would expect in a forest soil, and the formation of a litter layer, duff layer, whatever you want to call it. Goes by a lot of different names. Erosion would be the removal, physical removal of material from the soil surface. Sometimes this is not real easy to see, but if you look on, a lot of times it's best expressed on cultivated landscapes when they don't have anything growing on them. You can see all the different color patterns here where it's lighter colored there. That could be a BK horizon starting to peak up that used to be further below the surface. The darker areas down here might be the A horizon material that's eroded from the upper parts of the landscape. But it's a very active process. And I think I mentioned some erosion is geologic. It goes on all the time. It's natural, but what we're mostly concerned about in terms of management is the what we call accelerated erosion, which is what happens when we clear fields and harvest forests and that type of thing. Leaching, mentioned this is the removal of something from soil via the percolating water. And I think I might have said things like calcium, magnesium, potassium. Those are things that eventually get leached from the soil profile over time. And that's why when you start thinking about these really highly weathered soils or extremely leached soils, they tend to be very low in plant nutrients because a lot of this stuff is pretty much gone. And then we start getting into this idea of the relocation or the transfers of material. So we're not losing anything or gaining anything, we're just redistributing it. And the couple process we call eluviation and illuviation. So in this case, we're moving things from what looks like an E horizon down to some sort of a B horizon. And there's some more specific examples. I mentioned Les Sauvages, and this is the movement of clay as water moves down in the soil. So in this profile, it's forming a BT horizon. And when you have this Les Sauvages, mentioned that you should see this evidence as in the form of argillans or clay films, that the clays have been transported from up above. And these clay films tend to be on ped faces. Maybe if it's a sandier soil, coarser textured, you might see the clay film on some of the sand grains, maybe even bridging a couple of sand grains. But it's generally on the surfaces of aggregates and larger mineral grains. Calcification, decalcification, and you can see the soil profile here. This is image 13. The BK horizon down here, and the white in there is what we call secondary calcium carbonate. In other words, it has moved or formed in this horizon as a result of the chemical reactions going on up above. And I think I gave you we wrote out the equations here, and it's really a coupled process, calcification, decalcification, and you can see that in the upper part of the soil, because of the roots and microbial respiration, you have a lot of CO2. You generally tend to have more water up there. And what that does is it tends to drive the reaction this way. So you solubilize calcium and you get bicarbonate ion. It moves downward into the BK. The soil dries out. There's less CO2 and the reaction goes back the other way and the calcium carbonate precipitates out. So you end up with a BK horizon. Really important in soils from arid and semi-arid regions because they almost always have calcium carbonate in them. I think I mentioned salinization, desalinization. It's just salts, soluble salts. You can see the salt crust up at the surface of that soil, an AZ horizon, probably a BZ horizon below it. That's our designation for accumulation of soluble salts. And the fancy name would be salinization, at least in this case, the upper part of that soil. Podzolization, that was the big word for the day, and we call this the chemical migration of humus, often chelated with aluminum and iron. I don't know if I use that word chelated, but what does that mean? Humus, when it's chelated with aluminum and iron. Anybody remember from chemistry what a chelate is? Well, in this case, if you think about aluminum and iron in a well-drained soil, they are not very mobile constituents. They tend to form extremely resistant compounds, these iron and aluminum oxides, that'll stay put for a long time. But when you have this type of humus, and it's a soluble type of humus, what it does is it hooks up with aluminum and iron, and it renders them more mobile or soluble, and that's why we see them actually moving down in the soil profile. So it's moving out of the E horizon and then forming this BHS horizon. Desilication, chemical migration of silica from soil, leaving a residual concentration of sesquioxides, or what we describe as a BO horizon. So we're not adding iron and aluminum oxides to the soil, we're simply removing silica. And if you think about most soils and geologic materials, silica is the second most abundant element on a weight basis. But over time, you tend to remove that from a soil. What gets left behind are iron and aluminum oxides, and they end up being the dominant elemental components. Something, this desilication, we really only see it to best expressed in soils of the humid tropics, where you had pretty intense weathering for a long time.
Huh.
Yeah?
So does chelated just mean like attached to them?
Yeah, it's just a simple, we'll talk a little bit more about this, but it's just a bonding, a chemical bond that forms between the humus and either aluminum or iron. And organic matter competes pretty well for metals in soil, so there's a strong tendency for the humus to bind onto aluminum and iron and then it transports it down. Think of it as teamwork. Okay, the last thing is this idea of transformations where, again, we're not gaining or losing anything, we're just sort of changing the form of what's there. And probably the simplest way to think about this is the couple process of decomposition and synthesis. And it can happen with organic materials, like on a forest floor. These leaf materials drop to the forest floor, they're fresh. Over time, they're going to get decomposed. And if you look real carefully in this picture, you can probably see that some of these leaves are in varying states of decomposition. Here's one that's pretty far gone, and it's maybe not that easy to see, but over time, that plant material is going to be converted into soil organic matter, right? So that's a very complicated type of decomposition synthesis process. So we're decomposing the plant material, and at the same time, we're synthesizing soil organic matter. And it also works for minerals. This is an amphibole mineral, a close-up. You can see the crystal structure here. And what happens is, as this thing weathers in a soil, we're actually seeing the formation of other minerals. So the amphiboles have iron in them, one of the common ingredients. And as these things weather, we get iron oxides, and that's what this stuff is in there, maybe a type of iron oxide that's forming as that amphibole mineral weathers. We also get clays forming. So we're just transforming that mineral. It's decomposing or weathering, and we're also synthesizing something new from it. Some other examples, humification. You know, this is the decomposition of organic materials to form humus. It can be root material, like you see here. I already gave you the example of the forest floor, the leaf material being decomposed and then synthesized into humus. And then your book mentions this palletization, which is accumulation of deep organic deposits, you know, peats and so on. And it's generally something that's going to occur in an environment where there is something restricting the breakdown, the decomposition of the organic material. And as a result, it tends to pile up. And this would be an example in a bog where you start to get this really thick organic deposit just because it's so wet. These were three terms that were in the table in your book, and they're kind of scary looking, but if you dissect the meaning, it's really not that complicated. Braunification, anybody know any German? What's Braun mean? Brown. And rubification, it just refers to the development of different colors, ferrugination. So braunification, you get the brown colors, and I call these medium brown colors like you see in the subsoil. The rubification, more of a reddish brown color, and then over here, ferrugination would be the really red colors. And of course, you got everything in between. But what is it that's giving all of those soils the brown, reddish brown, or red colors? Iron oxides. It's just different types of iron oxides, and we'll talk more about them, but this one is a different iron oxide than what you see here, which is different than what you see in there. Glazation, this is the development of low chroma colors as a result of the reduction of iron, or what we're seeing in this particular example, the formation of a BG horizon. It could be a CG horizon, doesn't really matter. But normally, in a subsoil, we expect to see colors like that. But when we see colors like this, pretty good indication that glazation has taken place. And this is associated with a high water table, waterlogged conditions, anaerobic conditions. And we'll talk a little bit more about this too. But this one thing to keep in mind, this is a microbially mediated process, okay? It's the microbes that are doing this reduction of iron, and they're more or less what's responsible for the development of the gray colors. Then there's a couple more general terms like hardening, which we use to refer to any kind of a decrease in porosity or an increase in bulk density. If you remember from intro soils, bulk density and porosity are very closely related. Bulk density goes up, porosity goes down. Porosity goes up, bulk density goes down. But in this case, we're decreasing porosity, increasing the bulk density. Best example we have around here, remember the X refers to frangipans. And these are dense subsurface horizons. They've got a bulk density of about 1.6, maybe 1.7 grams per cubic centimeter. Don't have a lot of porosity, and they don't have very well-connected pore spaces. So it's a pretty tough environment for roots. It doesn't facilitate water movement, a lot of issues with it. The opposite of that would be loosening, and that's the increase in porosity, a decrease in bulk density. And a local example would be maybe up on Moscow Mountain where we have granitic bedrock. And you've all seen hard granite, right? Well, it's not too difficult to find areas where you have what would be what we would designate as a CR horizon, which is the soft weathered bedrock. So it still looks like rock, but it has weathered to the point where you can dig through it relatively easily with a shovel. And so it reflects this loosening or a decrease in bulk density. The granite rock has probably got a density of 2.6 or something on that order. Whereas when you get into a CR horizon, maybe the bulk density is down to about 1.8 or somewhere in that range. So it's getting low enough that we've got enough porosity we can work our way through it with a shovel. Whoops. It's a good word, pedoturbation. Turbation, you probably heard that term. If you throw pedo in front of it, it's just any soil mixing. And typically, this is done by organisms, and you might see the term biopedoturbation, which is a good one to throw in a conversation. Here's an example, I think I showed you this before. I talked about Crotovinas. That's an example of biopedoturbation or bioturbation, whatever you want to call it. But it's just this physical mixing of the soil matrix as a result of burrowing and that sort of activity. There's cryoturbation, which is the mixing as a result of frost and ice action. And I think I showed you this picture before, but this is a pretty complicated soil profile from up in Alaska. And a lot of these horizons that you see, they're broken up, irregular boundaries and that type of thing. It's because of the freezing and ice action. You got this gigantic ice wedge in there. And what it's done is just completely disrupted the fabric of the soil. You can imagine this horizon, the CF2, this might have all been one continuous horizon. You get this ice moving through there, it breaks it up. Same with this and these guys as well. So something we don't see that much around here, but certainly when you get up in the tundra areas and where you have gelisols and cold soils, it's a pretty big process. And the last one, I call it dendroturbation. You've all seen tree tip out in the forest. And depending on the tree, this is a fairly old western red cedar. And there's a tremendous amount of mixing and turbation that occurs when one of these things goes over. Because they've got a huge root ball, and they all gets pulled up. And you just think any horizons that might have formed under that tree are probably all mixed up now. And what that tree tip has done is just erase maybe centuries, if not millennia of soil formation. So it can be a very important process in forest environments. Okay, any questions about those processes? Yeah.
You can put all together. I mean, you can say that the soil has acidification, permeation, and so on, or you are better to just focus on one.
Well, there are going to be some soils that are dominated by a single process. I would say mollisols as a group. What would be the dominant process that you would associate with mollisols? They have a thick, dark surface horizon, right? So in terms of a process, what would that be? Humification or melanization, because that dark coloration. And spodosols, another example. What's the dominant, actually the defining process in a spodosol? No, remember that fancy of podzolization? So there are going to be certain soils that are, you know, that is the overriding process, but there may be others going on as well. So yeah, you can have a whole combination, a whole suite of these things that are operative. Any other questions? All right, well, let's switch and I want to get into the next thing, and that we're going to go back to the soil forming factors, okay? So these are the processes that we've been talking about. And what we're going to do now is look at these five soil forming factors. And really, the context for this is how these soil forming factors affect the processes. Because I think you'll all agree, these processes are what form different types of horizons, obviously, whether it's an EBHS horizon sequence or a BT horizon or a BG horizon. Those are process driven. But what these soil forming factors do is they determine the extent to which those processes are operative. And we'll kind of see how that works here. So I want to start off with climate. And if you had to summarize why climate is important, I would put these two things down. The first one is that water drives many, if not most, of those four generalized processes. Whether you're moving things around in the soil or you're transforming things in the soil, it takes water to do it. If you're leaching things out of the soil, it takes water to do it. And so, if you think about climate and you know, the aspect of it that we're most often concerned with is something like mean annual precipitation. The greater the mean annual precipitation, the more water that you've got to work with to drive these processes. And then the second part of that is that climate exerts a really strong effect on vegetation. I don't think that's news to any of you, but at the same time, it's pretty difficult sometimes to separate out the specific effects of climate versus the effects of vegetation, because they really do go hand in hand, and we see great examples here in the West. But I'll show you some examples of these things. So let's talk about the aspects of climate. I mentioned precipitation is one of the things that we consider, right? And what are the components of precipitation that we would use as a way of describing or quantifying climate? Okay, which is generally expressed as what? Mean annual precipitation is probably a pretty good way to look at it. And that's certainly one of the ways that we do look at it. So quantity, mean annual precipitation. I guess those of us in the West, especially, this can be kind of troublesome because it's a mean annual precipitation. And as you know, one year it could be half that mean, and the next year it might be twice that mean. I remember I had a statistics professor, and he used to say that averages were probably one of the most misunderstood statistical parameters, because his example was, if you're standing with 1 foot in a campfire and 1 foot in a bucket of ice water, on average you're pretty comfortable. But in actuality, you're not comfortable at all. So you might want to keep that in mind with this idea of means. But the other aspect of precipitation that we really need to consider is the temporal distribution. When does it come? Because this makes a big difference in how much precipitation is available to drive these soil-forming processes, and also, depending on when it comes, that has a big influence on the plant communities as well. Okay, the other aspect of climate that we commonly think about is temperature. And what's the most common way of describing temperature in an area? Soil, geographic area, whatever you want to think of it.
Average?
Yeah, again, we tend to use a mean annual air, or if we want to talk specifically about soils, a mean annual soil temperature. And you might make a note that you'll probably see this abbreviated MAST, and that refers to a mean annual soil temperature, which, let me ask you this. If I asked you guys to measure say we're interested in the mean annual soil temperature of the soil right outside this building. How would you measure it?
Data loggers.
Okay, so you put temperature probes in and data loggers, and then how often would you take a reading? Every half hour, you'd end up with a bunch of data. And how long would you do it?
The whole year.
And where would the temperature probe be? The surface?
5 to 10 centimeters in the soil.
Okay. Well, that's that'd be one way to do it. You'd have a lot of data to sort through. Anybody got an easier way? Anyone lazy? Yeah, okay.
Oh, you're asking if we were lazy yet.
Oh, well, all right. How would you measure mean annual soil temperature then? Well, you can go out and do this thing where you put in some sort of a temperature probe, or you could run out there with a thermometer every day and measure the temperature and then average those out over the course of a year, and that'll work. The other thing you can do is use the mean annual air temperature. And what we typically find is that there's a pretty good relationship between those two. And generally speaking, the mean annual soil temperature is going to be within a couple degrees of the mean annual, the mean annual soil temperature and the mean annual air temperature will be within a couple degrees of one another. Hannah.
So does that mean like if the annual air temperature is like in the 90s or something like that, that we expect to see the soil temperature like in the like 87 to 93 kind of
thing? Yeah, it sounds like you're describing hell though. Now remember, this is mean annual temperature. If it was that hot all the time, it's either hell or Texas, one of the two. Okay, now think about here, okay? Our mean annual air temperature in Moscow is about 48 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? And our mean annual soil temperature would be right around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. But that doesn't mean that if you go out there and measure the temperature, it's going to be 50 degrees all the time, right? Let me show you. This will come a little bit later. I'm going to come back to that, okay, how we'll do it. But I want to show you these maps first. This map on the upper, yeah.
How deep are the soil?
It doesn't matter because we're talking about the mean annual. And whether you measure it at the surface or you measure it at 2 feet below the surface or 6 feet below the surface, it's going to be the same. The difference is how often you have to measure it. If you're measuring it at the surface, you probably got to do it multiple times a day because it's going to be, during the summer, it's going to be really hot. During midday, it's going to cool off at night. Whereas if you're down at about 6 feet or so, it's not going to vary that much. And that's why if you were lazy.
All ears now.
Okay. I would say the best way to do it is go out there. If you really wanted to take a measurement, go out there, dig down to about 5 or 6 feet, stick a thermometer in, and that'd be a pretty good estimate of the, you'd be down to that zone where you're really not going to see much fluctuation. I've got a good figure here I'll show you in a minute. Yeah, Bryce?
It seems like it fluctuates less, like if there's a canopy layer or something like
that. Yeah, that's a good point. It fluctuates a lot less with the canopy. And with a litter layer, it's a great insulating layer.
But that mean will still, that roughly will still be accurate on both.
Mm-hmm. The thing that you'll see with a litter layer in the forest, what it'll do is keep that soil cooler in the summertime. So we'll come back to this in just a second. But this map, upper left-hand corner, is the soil orders, and so it's very general. And then here's the annual precip map for the United States. And you notice, compare that down here, this is Kukler's potential natural vegetation of the conterminous USA. And I guess the reason I put all these together, if you sit here and stare at them, what you're gonna see, there's some pretty broad patterns that are discernible between these different things, where you have a particular vegetation type and how that's associated with a particular soil type and how that's associated with particular annual precipitation. The way this annual precip thing works, the blue colors are the highest precipitation. Notice southeastern United States and how well that corresponds to this orange color that you see on the soil orders map. Anybody want to guess what the orange color is? What soil order?
Yeah.
No.
Citrus.
Well, the red clays, the ultisols of the southeast. So, and then you've got vegetation types associated with those. Start getting drier, you get into the grassland types. You see the shift from ultisols to alfisols to mollisols, the grassland soils. Again, the western United States, it's a mess because of the abrupt changes in elevation and this associated climate gradients with them. But I guess the point is that there's a pretty good correlation between these things, and it's really difficult to separate out specific cause and effect. But just think of them, the precip and soil type and vegetation are all related to one another. Okay, back to this idea of mean annual precipitation. Here are a couple figures that show the relationship between mean annual precip and two different soil characteristics. This first one is, this is soil depth. This is rainfall going from left to right across the top. This is the relationship between depth to calcium carbonate and mean annual rainfall. Now, is this surprising? As you increase the rainfall, what happens to the depth where you find calcium carbonate? It increases as well. And pretty good relationship. There's a few points that scatter a little bit, but by and large, it's a pretty strong relationship. Okay, this one on the right is mean annual precipitation, and this is depth to the maximum clay content, or think about this as the best expressed BT horizon that you'd have in a soil profile. They kind of goofed up the way they structure this, but what's the relationship? Well, as you increase mean annual precipitation, the depth to the maximum clay content gets greater. So you find that BT horizon further and further down, or that maximum clay content. And this again is just a testament to the fact that water is what drives these translocations, whether it's calcification, decalcification, or lessivage. It's really directly influenced by precip. Okay, we mentioned, yeah.
So I have a question about the soil temperature deal.
Okay.
You're talking about digging down 6 feet, seeing what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Say you had like a hole in the ground, you know, it's not huge, but it's been there for a while, like you didn't just dig it. Is the soil temperature at 6 feet then, like if I stick it an inch into the ground at the bottom of that hole, is that still gonna represent what everything is?
Be pretty close.
Okay.
We're going to come back to this in just a second, okay?
Okay.
So just hold that thought.
All right.
This is something known as a soil-water balance. You'll be seeing these again, okay? And what this tries to capture is the seasonal or temporal distribution of precipitation. And here's the thing. These are the months of the year. January, so you've got the calendar year here, and this happens to be in Louisiana. How many of you have been to Louisiana? What's the climate like there?
It's
hot and humid, it rains all the time, and so this would be an example of how you might construct a water balance, and this takes into account the water that the soil will store and so on. This line right here, the dashed line, represents the precip, okay? This line right here, it comes up, peaks in July, June, and comes down, is potential evapotranspiration. And that simply is the maximum amount of water that can be transpired by plants or evaporated from plant surfaces, soil surfaces. In other words, it's water demand, right? And it's going to be greatest during the height of the growing season. Well, if you look at distribution of rainfall, it's not that bad. It's a little bit drier here in September. It drops down to about 2 inches per month, which is maybe low for there. But we'll look at these in more detail. But for right now, the point is that for most of the growing season, the plants in this area have plenty of water. They experience very little water deficit. Whereas you could take that exact same amount of total precipitation, which is 49 inches, and if it all came in the 2 months during the winter time, what would that help the plants? Not very much. It wouldn't help them at all. So We really need to think about that. And contrast this with our climate here. Dry in the summer, we get most of our precip during the winter months when the plants aren't doing much. So from the plant standpoint, it's not very effective, but from the soil standpoint, it helps. It means there's more water available to drive the soil forming process. And here's an explanation or an illustration of that. This topsoil profile here is a soil profile from Kansas, and it's a mollisol. It's a prairie soil. This is our good old Palouse silt loam, also formed under native prairie. Both of these areas get about 24 inches of mean annual precipitation, right? But as I said, ours comes during the winter months, and in Kansas, the majority, it's actually western Kansas, but the majority of the precip comes during the
summer
growing season and early part of the summer. So from a plant standpoint, where are you going to be happier? When would you rather have the precip? During the growing season or during the winter? During the growing season. So what happens, that means the plants in Kansas use a greater percentage of that precipitation, whereas here, all this moisture that we get now is not being used by plants, so it's available to move down through the soil, and as it does that, it moves things along, you get these transfers, and specifically calcium carbonate. So same amount of mean annual precip, but the soil from Kansas has carbonate at a depth of about 3/4 of a meter, somewhere in there, and you can see the BK horizon. Whereas our Palouse soil, because we're getting that precip when the plants aren't growing, it's free to move on down and we get much more decalcification and calcification. And in a lot of the Palouse profiles, you can go down below a meter and you're still not going to find any calcium carbonate. This figure, this out of your textbook, but finally down here at maybe a meter and a half, you might start to get a little bit of calcium carbonate. But you can see the difference that the timing of the precip makes in whether or not you have a BK horizon and where that BK horizon is in the soil profile. Okay, temperature. Here's the temperature map of the U.S. Not surprising, really hot. Southern tip of Texas, Florida, Phoenix area, and then as you get up further north, it cools off. Okay. Here's a figure out of your book. It gets back to this idea of temperature fluctuation. So here's soil depth. There's the surface. This is down to a depth of about 50 centimeters. And then here's the temperature. What it's showing is the diurnal soil temperature variation with depth. And I think this is in Madison, Wisconsin in the summertime. So here's what's going on. Sunrise, 6 a.m. Look at the temperature profile. It's cooler at the surface, and then as you go down, it actually warms up a little bit. At 12 noon, it's gotten really hot up at the soil surface, and as you go down in the soil, it cools off, right? And then this one right here is 9 o'clock in the morning. You can see it's kind of intermediate, and then at sunset, it's kind of changing again. But you notice you get down to that 50 centimeter mark, thereabouts, and that's generally taken to be the depth where you don't see much diurnal fluctuation in temperature. And we can take that same idea that you've got these widely fluctuating temperatures up at the surface, but as you get further down in the soil, that fluctuation is dampened. How many of you have lived someplace with a basement? Okay, think about this. When you go down in the basement in the summertime, does it feel good?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it's cool. What about when you go down in the basement in the wintertime? Does it feel good? Well, it depends on a lot of other things, but the point is that basement's probably going to be pretty close to the same temperature, whether it's summer or winter. You're not going to see that sort of fluctuation. Whereas upstairs, you know, where you've got the something more like this going on with the temperature fluctuations, you're not going to maintain that constant temperature. So if this graph was extended and you went down to about a meter, maybe 2 meters, you would get to a point down here where not only would you not see any diurnal fluctuation in temperature, you wouldn't even see seasonal fluctuation in temperature. And so if you're really lazy and you want to know the mean annual soil temperature, go. Well, if you're really lazy, you'll have somebody else dig the hole for you. But go down about 2 meters, stick a thermometer in there, and use that as an estimate, because you're probably to the point where you're not seeing any kind of seasonal fluctuation in temperature. Does that make sense? So this sounds weird, but think about it, that mean annual soil temperature, if you try to measure it and you do it correctly, it doesn't matter if you go out there and take a measurement at the surface several times a day over the course of the year, or you go further down in the soil profile, take fewer measurements. You know, you should end up with the same number, because it's the mean annual soil temperature, right? And it should be independent of where you're measuring it. The big difference is how often you have to measure it. Okay, well, what I want to do, I'll stop here, but this afternoon, I'm going to finish this up with the climate, and we're going to talk a little bit about organisms as soil forming factor. And then you guys can finish up the exercise on the doing the soil horizons.